I'm Bailey Parnell, and this is Let's Think This Through. Join me for drinks as I bring on guests for conversations that inspire, amuse, and challenge us, but in a fun and relaxing kind of way. Ultimately, it's to help us all learn and live a better, easier life. So let's think this through. Good morning, thinking buddies. This next guest and I have been trying to catch up for a while. He met my husband in Australia years ago, and then we were connected because from the other side of the planet, we do something pretty similar. He also does work that takes these big soft skills, these big human skills, and in his case, the skill of happiness, and breaks them down into things that people can learn. Yes, imagine that, happiness as a learnable skill. Well, we were introduced shortly before he embarked on a four-month sabbatical to South America. And so I've been really looking forward to having a drink with him and talking about the trip and about happiness and about a bunch of other things too. So I'd really like you all to meet that happiness guy, my friend, Declan Edwards. Declan, welcome to Let's Think This Through.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to it.
So how are you introducing yourself to people these days when they ask, like, what do you do?
Man, the one that has stuck started as a bit of a joke, but I'm really enjoying it over the last few years and leaning into it. And that's that happiness guy. It's what I've become a bit known for. And that started because I was showing up to these events and I was introducing myself. I was like, hey, I'm Declan Edwards. And a few people in a row just went, wait a second, I know you. Aren't you that happiness guy? Like, you talk about happiness, you research happiness. And I went, this is hilarious. I'm just going to embrace it. And so now, I mean, even on LinkedIn, it's Declan, that happiness guy, Edwards. So yeah, I guess the best way to say, who am I? What do I do? I'm a happiness researcher and I'm kind of affectionately known, I'd like to say, as that happiness guy.
Oh, I can see it for sure. And in a way, that's what your business does too. You've kind of extended that happiness guy to be that happiness business, no?
100%.
Yeah, I see it. So then what beverage have you brought here today?
Oh, I have got a refreshing limonada de coco. So I've just returned from close to 5 months in South America. And I'll tell you what, I was having one of these daily in Colombia.
Okay, what's
Non-alcoholic.
In it?
Non-alcoholic. So it's so easy. It's three ingredients. So really good quality coconut milk, a bit of sugar or sugar syrup, and then fresh lime. Blend it all together with some ice and you're good to go. And if you want to make it extra fancy, I didn't today because I was worried about getting it stuck in my teeth for the recording. But mint in it just goes so nicely. I just didn't want to have all the green mint leaves through my teeth.
Oh, that's a really good point. I don't know if I would have thought about that. I love that. Inspired by you, I actually brought sparkling lemon lime drink, also non-alcoholic. Because gorgeous. So, cheers to you.
Cheers. Or salud, as they say in South America.
Salud. Yeah, and do you know what's interesting? I got this because I thought it was cool. It would be a cool mix, but apparently it's the drink that, do you know Blake Lively?
Oh, yeah.
The actress? Apparently it's her drink. And I was like, that's neat.
Betty
Buzz, yeah.
Betty Buzz, yes. Okay, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, you're pretty good. But no, this is non-sponsored, so that's literally just my own thinking about it. But I do want to hear more about South America. So where were you there?
So my wife and I started in Chile. We flew into Santiago, and we spent the next 4.5 months basically working our way north up the west coast of South America. So through Chile, Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, and finishing in Colombia.
Which is incredible. And I know that when I met you, geez, in 2023, you were just preparing for this. So what motivated this in the first place? And back then you called it a sabbatical.
Yeah. So I think a couple of things came at the same time to really push my wife and I to go, yep, let's do this. We'd been speaking about traveling South America since we first started dating when we were 19 years old. You know, this has been something that for a long time we kept going, one day we'll get there. And, you know, we fell into that trap that I think a lot of people get stuck in, the whole one day we'll make it happen. But now it's not the right time. And there was always a reason why now wasn't the right time. And then eventually we got to a point where I went, hey, you know, last year in 2023, I turned 30. I had been running BU Happiness College for close to 7 years by then. I finished my master's thesis and graduated from that. There was all these things that were kind of, I guess, chapters ending at the same time. And it felt like we were really stepping into a new chapter in our life, personally and professionally. And I went, you know what? Let's finally do this. And it started as a bit of an idea to just go for 3 months and then extended and blew out to 4.5, close to 5. But really the intention and purpose behind it was to have a bit of breathing room and space to kind of reconnect with ourselves, reconnect with, I guess, what we wanted this next chapter of our lives to look like. You know, I'd gone straight from high school to university, straight from university to running a startup, straight from that into doing a master's thesis. I'd never really taken that proper break away to go, you know, what's the next step look like for me? And there was all the reasons why it wasn't the right move. You can look on paper and go, you know, well, we're still growing the company. Is it ready to run without me for that long? But I just got to the point where I was like, I'm not going to look back on my life 30, 40 years from now and remember those extra 4.5 months that I worked and the extra deals that we bought in for the, you know, for the organization. I'm going to remember that trip that I took with my wife, you know, especially because we're now talking about starting a family. This is sort of a big thing to do together before that. And yeah, we kind of went with I always use this analogy of, I think the best decisions in life are preceded by a blend of seemingly contradictory emotions. So whether that be challenge and freedom, or in this case, fear and excitement. I was like, I'm feeling equally nervous about this as I am excited by it. And that's a good sign. And so, off
yeah. Well, I am dying to know. I've been wondering ever since I first met you. I knew I was going to ask this question. I'm so glad it got to be on the podcast. But what did you take away? Have you had any time to kind of for integration about, you know, some lessons learned on the trip?
Yeah, I think the biggest, well, there was two really big ones. So one was kind of a personal learning, reconnecting with myself. I really came to understand my core values a lot more clearly. I think when I had the space to step away from, funnily enough, being known automatically as that happiness guy and being known automatically for my work, I could just meet people along the way and figure out who I was and what mattered to me without my professional self having a role in that. And I really got clear on my two core driving needs are impact and experience. And throughout the trip, I was like, I'm getting experience in bucket loads. You know, we're like climbing mountains, we're swimming in our own rivers. You know, we're doing all these incredible things. I feel so enriched in that space, but my sense of impact is lacking a little bit. I don't feel like I'm making a difference whilst I'm over here traveling. And so we tried to look for ways to travel more ethically and more responsibly, try to make sure we're making an impact on the local economy and the local people we're visiting. But it also gave me a really deep appreciation for the work I get to do as a happiness researcher and at BU Happiness College, because I get impact from that, you know, in such spades. I was in a fortunate position to be traveling and looking forward to going back to my work, whereas a lot of people I met over there were, let's just say, not in that camp. And so that was a huge realization to come back to those core values for myself and go, okay, well, that's what I would like to build my life around, making sure I'm meeting both of those needs. And then on a more of a professional standing, again, it gave me the space to look at what we were building with BU and go, is this what I want to build? And, you know, I'd historically gone when I first started BU Happiness College, I remember saying to people, I want to build the Harvard of happiness. You know, I want physical locations and campuses around the world. I want hundreds of staff. I want to have thousands of enrollments.
Right.
And I just came to realize that I don't want that anymore. You know, I want a simpler life that is very aligned to the difference I want to make in the world, but also gives me a lot of the space and freedom to pursue things outside of that and to not get my entire sense of self and identity absorbed into my work.
And
so it was very beautiful to have those lessons.
Sounds incredible, because one of the things that you said that just stood out to me is, you know, when you said one of the things that motivates you, you said experiences and impact. And so, you know, coming back to your work and your life and thinking, I want to have high impact, it sounds like there was a realization that more offices and more employees does not necessarily mean impact.
Correct. Yeah, it was vanity metrics. It was, this is what success looks like in theory and on paper, but is that what success means to me personally? Maybe not.
That's right. And so have you gained a bit of clarity on what success does mean for BU? Or can you say it yet? It's only been 2 weeks since you returned.
Yeah, no, I have. And it's been really nice to have the team that is on board with BU, you know, the support coaches that I have who help me deliver our services and our programs, really take this journey with me. I kind of drew BU on a napkin whilst I was over in South America, the classic, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's get a napkin and draw it. But yeah, people are asking,
in a frame someday.
Right, they're like, what in the world is a happiness college? They're like, what does that even mean? It's not really a well-known industry yet. And I started with this idea of like, okay, well, fundamentally, over 10 years of researching happiness and positive psychology now, I've come to deeply believe that happiness is a skill. It's a series of skills that the more we learn them, the happier we tend to be in life. Things like self-compassion, things 100%. Like empathy, things like resilience, emotional intelligence. But they're skills that a lot of people don't get exposed to. You know, if you didn't learn it at school, then you keep your fingers crossed that you were the one of the lucky few that had very emotionally intelligent parents who could teach you at home. And I know there'd be people listening to this that went, Declan, my parents did not teach me those skills at home because they didn't know them. Right. And so 100%. If you're not learning them at home and you're not learning them at school, where do you learn them? And then I went, right, well, that's kind of the core goal. Where do we, like, these are the skills we need to work on. And then I branched it out into three, I guess, arms, which is, where do we need these skills taught? First and foremost, on an individual level. So that's the college, that's for people to do personal happiness coaching, that's people taking their own personal development journeys. The second arm, which we started 3 years ago, which is our fastest growing, is on an organizational level. That's what my master's thesis was on.
That's
how
right.
do we make happiness a core KPI in organizations and hold organizations accountable to their impact on happiness? And then the third arm, and this is what I'm most excited about, this is kind of part of what I was doing research on whilst I was away, is on a national level. How do we make happiness a core part of government policy? How do we encourage more nations to measure their success, not just on GDP and on economic growth, but on the well-being and happiness of their citizens? And so in terms of what BU looks like in the future, I would hope that we have a service or a product that I'm deeply proud of in each of those three branches.
Well, I think you and Hamza might be collaborating sooner than you think, because this idea of GDP being replaced by a kind of global wellness index is something top of mind for him for sure. And I think you guys would probably be Australia meets Canada, US, covering a lot of the globe.
That's a good case study to take to other countries.
Well, you know, actually, it's funny because when I mentioned to Hamza that I was going to be chatting with you, because they will have heard in the intro how we met and they know that you know Hamza as well. One of the first things Hamza said was, oh yeah, you need to ask him about his near-death experience. So I know I'm the host of this thing, but I was like, and that Hamza's giving me a question right now, but I was like, wait, yes, I do. Yes, I do need to ask about that. So what on earth has happened here?
Yeah, I mean, look, this came about, it was probably one of the most pivotal moments in my development as a person and I guess letting go of a lot of old habits I'd built, a lot of old ideas I'd built around what it meant to be a happy and successful individual. I grew up very much struggling with self-esteem issues, with self-doubt, with, I like to joke that I'm a recovering high achiever and a recovering human chameleon. I was very good at being what I thought everyone else wanted me to be. And as a result, I lost touch with who I was. But at the time, I remember going, I get love, I get acceptance, I get connection, I get all these things that I'm craving when I achieve. Right now, whether that means in school, on the basketball court, when I was growing up playing basketball, I got stuck in this trap of like, I will chase happiness around the next success, around the next accomplishment. And the more I struggled and grappled with my own insecurities and my own self-doubt, the bigger the bar became. The more it was like, well, I need to raise up the ante here. I need to achieve more and more and more if I'm ever going to hope for, you know, recognition and love from other people, and therefore hopefully recognition and love from myself. And so kind of at the peak of that journey at 19 or so years old, you know, coming out of high school, figuring out what it means to be an adult, I mean, what's the biggest achievement I could go for? I'm going to climb Everest. I'm going to climb the world's highest mountain. And then I'll be worthy as a person. You know what I mean? Then I'll be someone. So I wanted to do it right. So I messaged a climbing company and said, what do you need to see from me? Because I don't want to be one of those people who just shows up on Everest and pays the ticket and then is a danger to themselves and everyone else.
Right.
And they went, well, we need to see you climb some big mountains. We need to see you prove that you can do this. And so off I went. I climbed to Everest Base Camp with my first coach and mentor. I did some mountaineering training in Australia. And then the next step was Kilimanjaro in Africa. And I went, okay, let's do this. And, you know, BU had started by then. So I went, let's double it up as our first ever international happiness expedition. Let's take members with us.
Oh, neat. Okay.
And so we took my wife, some of our family, some graduates of BU, some current members of BU, and we're like, let's go climb the highest mountain in Africa. Now, I went in cocky because I'd already done Everest Base Camp and I felt all right there, had no issues. I didn't train anywhere near enough for Killy. And the first few days of Killy weren't too much of a problem and they were all right. But then we hit the final day before you get to base camp and you're crossing something called the saddle and you're just getting absolutely buffeted by wind. It's cold. It's just everyone's feeling low energy and it's barren and you're high altitude. You're struggling to get oxygen. And the only thing keeping me going at the time was the promise of a hot meal at base camp and then a sleep before we went for summit attempt. And I went, okay, we'll get there and then we'll work things out. We get to base camp, we have our meal, and our expedition leader pulls me aside and goes, hey, the weather's not looking too good for an evening summit tonight. Because normally on Killy, you go to sleep after lunch, you wake up at midnight and you do a nighttime summit attempt.
Oh, interesting.
And then you make it to the top for sunrise. And he goes, the weather's not looking good for tonight. I'm worried about some of the group. I'm worried about altitude sickness. I'm worried about how we're going to go. And I said, well, what's the alternative? You know, if we're not going tonight, do we rest an extra night? You know, quite hopefully saying that we'll get an extra rest. And he goes, no, we need to go now, like immediately. And so in the space of 5 minutes, we'd gone from this relief of we're done for the day to we're now doing the hardest part. Steepest part, highest altitude part. And we went well into the night. I think we reached the crater lip, so the top of the mountain, but then you walk a bit further to get to the official summit. But at the top of the mountain at about midnight, and I was on all fours, crawling in the dirt, in tears. And altitude sickness is a weird thing. Like for me, the biggest thing I experienced, like I was definitely sick. I was not thinking clearly. I couldn't get my arms into the holes of my jacket to get warm.
Oh,
like,
geez.
I couldn't figure out how to do it. So people were trying to help me put my jacket on. And the thing I remember most clearly was becoming so ambivalent to my own mortality. I was lying there going, I want to sleep. And the guide's going, you can't sleep here. You'll die. Like you need to get off this mountain. And I distinctly remember going, I don't care anymore, which is not me. It's not like me at all. But to then thankfully get off the mountain and be taken down and you know, the whole team got off okay, which was great. But to then have that reflection of like, wow, I was so ambivalent to my own life for the sake of pursuing a goal that I set as an insecure 19-year-old. Like, do I even want to be here? Do I even want to be climbing these mountains?
Yeah.
And it gave me a good wake-up call. And I was like, there's a lot more to life than just chasing happiness in the next achievement or the next accolade. And since then, I've gone back to, I swore off high altitude mountaineering for a few years. I've done a little bit in South America over the last few months. And my relationship with it is so different now. It's so much healthier and more sustainable. And I think it's because I'm no longer gambling my sense of self-worth or my sense of happiness on whether or not I arbitrarily touch the summit of some mountain.
Well, I think that climbing and mountains give us just rich metaphors for really anything that you're trying to conquer or anything hard that you're trying to do. And it sounds like this realization, well, it must have influenced your approach to happiness research and coaching, did it?
Yeah, Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing it shifted within me is it kind of marked an era of changing from thinking of happiness in the hedonic sense. So hedonic happiness being very dopamine driven, accomplishment driven, external driven, still important. Mm. Like it's based around goal setting. It's based around progress. To now more of a, what they call in the happiness research, eudaimonic happiness, which is, I guess, a sense of like contentment and fulfillment. This is more connection led. It's more, it's a slower burn happiness. You know, it doesn't come as quickly, but it doesn't go as quickly either. If you asked me in my early 20s, you know, what blend of those two types of happiness did I think led to a happy life? I would have been like, man, 80% hedonic, you know, give me joy, excitement, success, accomplishment, accolades, and 20% eudaimonic. And I think now I'm nearly the exact opposite. I try to put about 80% of my focus into how do I feel connection, contentment, purpose, meaning, contribution, and then 20% topping up with, and how do I still do stuff that's really challenging that I'm really proud of?
Yeah, I think you've like that's evident in your work. What do you think it is about people confronting mortality? A bit philosophical, but what is it about confronting mortality from your perspective that gives people a new lease on life, if you will? And I would say, you know, I've heard lots of stories about people finding happiness after situations like that.
Yeah, this is a topic I've become intensely interested in over the last 5 or so years.
I thought so.
Particularly because of, the time in Kilimanjaro. There's actually a great book called Mortals. I'm forgetting the name of the authors, but it's an interesting combination of a father-daughter combo of psychologists in Australia who specialized in researching our relationship with mortality. And what they found through their research, and it really struck a chord with me, was like they put forward a really convincing argument that most of our struggles and challenges and even pursuits and successes as a species are an attempt to avoid the fact that we're mortal. You know, people create great works of art in the hope of being remembered long past their time. You know,
I understand completely.
We seek a sense of control in a very uncontrollable world and uncontrollable life because it gives us a little bit of security that maybe we can delay the inevitable approach of death. And so I think there was all these arguments of like a lot of our mental challenges, emotional challenges, and great accomplishments are linked to this like absolute fear of something that is going to happen to all of us. And this is particularly in a Western culture. You know, there's a lot of amazing cultures out there that do so well with not only accepting and acknowledging our mortality, but even celebrating it and honoring it. And I think we've got a long way to go in Western society with coming to terms with our own mortality and impermanence. You know, we want things to last forever. We struggle to embrace change, including in ourselves. And so, you know, when it comes to living a happier life and why we see so much research that shows people have these big realizations, these deep thoughts when they confront their own mortality, is because I think it cuts through a lot of the surface. It gets to the core very quickly. It helps us go, what actually matters? And we realize that so much that stresses us day to day and week to week doesn't bloody matter, right? And we can get to these deeper questions quite quickly.
I know. I see it for sure. It's it quickly puts into perspective what the goal is, really. You know, there's a lot of spiritual, philosophical, even scientific theories for what is the purpose of living, right? The purpose of being human. And what is the ultimate goal of living, which is definitely like a we're going there. But I think you would not be the only one to argue, you know, historically and even, like I said, spiritually, that the purpose is to achieve happiness. Now, of course, the trick of that, there's a lot of people proposing, like, you know, every marketer under the sun is trying to convince you that they have the answer to the happiness. But there is something I think about humans, once you become a conscious being and, you know, you live in cognitive tasks, that happiness becomes the goal even over lower order needs on the hierarchy.
Mm. Without a doubt.
I don't know. I haven't thought all this out, but this is just what we're doing here. So
yeah, no, and I agree with you. And I think like what's interesting that I'm seeing at the moment, there's almost, I'm seeing almost a rise of like a backlash to happiness, you know, on online where people are like, why pursue happiness in a world that's got so many challenges and struggles? Or don't chase happiness because it's fleeting. Focus on gratitude instead. Now, if you look at this from a positive psychology lens or from an emotional intelligence lens, right? Happiness is an umbrella term emotion. And under that, so you might call that, you know, the first tier emotions, happy, angry, sad, right? Those core big ones. Underneath the banner and umbrella of happiness is things like gratitude, contentment, meaning, purpose, as well as joy, excitement, elation. They're distinctly different forms of happiness, but they're all happiness. So when I see someone say, don't chase happiness because it's fleeting, I'm like, well, some of them are, but not all of them. Or when I say, people go, hey, don't prioritize happiness, prioritize gratitude. You know, ignore happiness, let's focus on gratitude. I saw the other day. I was like, that's like saying, ignore chocolate, just focus on Ferrero Rocher. Like, Ferrero Rocher is a type of chocolate. You know what I mean? It's like, you're still pursuing chocolate. Yeah. It's just, that's your flavor that you like, and that's okay. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, I genuinely believe at our core, every human being, you know, if you ask people enough, what do you want out of life, or what do you want for your kids and your loved ones, eventually you're going to land on, to some degree, I want happiness. Now, the expression of that or the flavor of that, people will have their own taste preferences. But at the core, people want to live a happy life. They want their loved ones to live happy lives. We want to contribute to the happiness of others. So I think it's an important goal to put front and center and not have as a hopeful byproduct. You know, the I'll be happy when trap. Maybe if I'm lucky, happiness will show up on a silver platter if I do X, Y, and Z.
So then what would you say are the core components to an individual's happiness?
I mean, the best evidence-based components come from positive psychology. There's a model called PERMA, which I'm a huge believer in. I think it does really well at balancing hedonic happiness that we spoke about earlier, that joy, elation, dopamine, rush happiness with that contentment, that eudaimonic, slower happiness. And so you look at the parts of PERMA, first and foremost, positive affect, which is just, do we do things that make us feel good? And I know that sounds ridiculously simple and, you know, kind of silly in a way.
No, it does not. It does not.
Right? But how often
I think people lose. We forget that sometimes. 100%. Yeah. I think people forget like, oh, you know, whether you can do a version of that that's, you know, free, all these sorts of things, right? Do I do things that I even liked to do as a kid? And there was a previous episode of this podcast where one of the guests was saying, if you want to live a really great adult life, find what you did as a kid and do it as an adult.
Right.
So that's the P in PERMA then.
Yeah. So just do things that make us feel good. That's positive affect. E is engagement and flow. So this is how often do we do things where we lose sense of self and lose sense of time. So we're fully present. We're immersed in it. It could be a creative pursuit. It could be a sporting pursuit. And what they've found is not only do people rate their lives as happier when they experience engagement and flow more often, but they also perform better. They're the best athletes, the best thinkers, the leaders in their fields are able to tap into that zone. And so doing things and finding your expression of flow is quite a beautiful pursuit to living a happier life. The R in PERMA is relationships. And more and more and more is this becoming clear that this is arguably one of the most important parts of PERMA. You know, I used to be a big believer in the saying, happiness comes from within. You know, happiness is an inside job. Now what I believe is happiness starts from within, but it's nurtured amongst us. Right? It's we drive
that
we may start.
Wow, that is so interesting.
If you want to really fulfill your happiness potential, you can't do it alone. It's that simple.
You know what's so funny, Declan, is I always plan out a segment for everyone, and we will definitely come back to the M and the A, but I always plan out a segment for each episode. And my segment for you was going to be one that was called On Second Thought, where we discuss things where the guest thinking yours has significantly evolved over time. And for you, I was thinking, you know, what's something that you maybe thought brought you happiness or how you defined happiness, and then you've had significant second thoughts about. And it sounds like you may have just named one of those things.
Definitely. One of the biggest ones, to be honest. You know, I very much, and I think, again, this is a reflection of culture. When you look at a lot of, westernized culture that tend to be more individualistic cultures, tends to be focused more on happiness as an individual pursuit. It's self-help. You as a individual self to help yourself.
Whereas not community care.
Right? Collectivist cultures, they have a bit more of a, hey, yeah, happiness at the end of the day, I still believe this to be true. Everyone's happiness is their own personal responsibility, right? And it's up to you to start the process on that and plant some seeds. But man, the impact that people have on nurturing those seeds, on helping us fulfill our potential as human beings, cannot be understated. And we're living through a time of peak loneliness in a lot of countries. The amount of people who say that they don't have a single close friend in their life that they could be open and vulnerable with is higher than ever.
Yeah.
And I think we have a long way to go hey, happiness does need to be a community approach, right? If we're going to really fulfill our potential as a species, we need to do this together.
For sure. So it sounds like then everyone listening would clarify this, which is a big one, really, because I think when people think that they're getting to, our first stage of wisdom and understanding, you think happiness comes from within. But really, we're saying there might actually be a transcended stage of this, which is, well, maybe it comes from within. But I like what you said. It might be nurtured by the community.
Yeah.
Right. So then what is the M?
Yeah, so the M in PERMA is meaning and purpose. And now that can be a big scary topic. You know, you mentioned before, like, what is the meaning and purpose of life? And we could have many discussions about that.
Yeah. I've got my own theories, no small feat.
Right? It's a big question. But the thing I love about this when it comes to how do we live happier as individuals is you don't necessarily have to solve that. Like, yes, explore it. Try to figure out for yourself what does a meaningful and purposeful life look like to you. But what it's more about is, can we imbue a sense of meaning and purpose in what we do day to day? You know, can we find something that seems, like a bit standard and arbitrary and doesn't really matter, and go, well, it actually stands for something bigger than itself. So a good example that I like to share is I'm one of those weird people who genuinely enjoys doing the dishes. Much to my wife's pleasure. She loves that I love doing the dishes.
Yeah, I bet.
Right. But sometimes she finds that she's like, man, you love doing them, but God, you take a long time. You know, like you'll spend 40 minutes doing the dishes that could be done in 10. And for me, it's such a mindful experience. I don't know what it is about it, but like I cannot be playing on my phone whilst I'm doing the dishes because my hands are wet. Right. I can't be doing so other things. I'm forced to be present for a little moment. And I find I have a lot of breathing room for my mind in that space. I just kind of reflect on my day. I ponder about what's coming up. And so for me, washing the dishes is not just about washing the dishes, right? It's kind of giving my brain a little bit of a breather and a bath as well. And so if we can do that in ourselves and go, what are things I do day to day? Why are they valuable to me? You know, the whole Simon Sinek start with why, that you could almost flip that and go, come back to why. Even if you didn't start with it, come back to it, right? And go, why is this valuable to me? And that's where we get a sense of meaning and purpose from in little touch-ups. And then the A is the fifth and final of the original PERMA model is accomplishment and achievement. And that's, as I've shared a lot in this, is, where I used to gamble and place a lot of my happiness chips. I probably wasn't putting many in a lot of the other parts of PERMA. And achievement and accomplishment can still be a beautiful part of living a happy life. Setting goals that matter to you, doing things that are challenging and tough, rising and accomplishing things that you've set yourself to is a great way to build self-worth, self-esteem. It's a great way to learn about ourselves. It's a great way to celebrate our strengths. As long as we're not gambling everything on it. Right. And so
you got me really thinking, for sure.
To balance it out.
I'm speaking at the same time as you, but you've really got me thinking about that for sure. But I like this PERMA model, and I'm a big fan of positive psychology. And I love how in our lifetime, this field is developing right in front of our eyes. And there's still so much that we don't know and that we haven't codified yet. But when you're saying this PERMA model, so we've got positive affect, we've got engagement, relationships, meaning and purpose, and the accomplishments. And I think, you know, maybe over-investing in any one of the five would be an error. If I was over-invested in just my relationships with no meaning to the things that I do alone, you know, you could see how there would be an error there. But probably what you're having me think more about is I'm thinking about kids, and I'm thinking about, you know, you and I both share this essence. It's one of the things we first bonded on, that there are these skills that can be skills that actually can be taught. And, you know, that all starts in childhood. And it's like all these things are popping to my brain right now about how you could help a kid learn PERMA just by way of, one, exposing them to things that they like to do for fun, by, you know, demonstrating engagement, by helping them have positive relationships, by showing them meaning to things that maybe, like when they're a kid, it's just such a beautiful thing because you have to make it obvious to them. Mm-hmm. If you want them to have meaning when they do laundry, it's not obvious to a 10-year-old yet. But imagine you say, you know, for us, having a clean home or whatever it is for you, you know, gives us that sense of calm. And I want you to have clean clothes when you go to school in the day. Like, this is what they're going to take away. And then, you know, accomplishments. I think this one we probably understand more is actually, wow, I could go on this whole tirade right now because for a kid to experience accomplishment, we're saying, you know what, this is really important to them understanding happiness. It's not about snowflake children. It's not about participation trophies. It's about teaching them, you know, how to be happy in a way, like how to find things that do work for them and don't work for them.
Mm. Hmm. Exactly. And you know, what's exciting is it's starting to happen. Like, I had a call literally a week ago. You know, I just got back from the break in South America, had a call from a teacher in a school in Queensland. So the state above me here in Australia. And he's like, hey, I heard you on a podcast recently talking about all this work. And I just got so excited because we've recently rolled out a positive education-based framework in our school. All of the students are learning the PERMA model. Gosh. We are building our education around it.
No way.
And I'm sitting there on the phone like, oh my God, this is the future I hoped for. We're living in it. We're living in the future I hoped for. Right? And so it's starting. Right. And I think that's so exciting. Exactly as you said, this field of research has really emerged since maybe the 90s. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not been around for that long. But to now see it being taken up by schools, by organizations, by hopefully we see more and more governments, you know, New Zealand, Canada, a lot of the Scandinavian countries have all said they're going to measure gross national happiness or gross national well-being. I'm very excited for what's coming for us as a species and as a global society.
Oh, you know. Couldn't agree more. And I think, like, whenever I see stuff like that or with Skills Camp, I would say if the ultimate success is we don't have to exist anymore because it's just, you understand, you got to parent social emotional skills like this, PERMA. It's just taught in schools. It's just understood that it's part of employee onboarding and all this sort. But, you know, in the countries that we're from, I'm from Canada and I'm in the US and Australia and New Zealand. We all have like a similar kind of background and very Western in culture, but you've just come back from South America and in your other travels, have you found that these components are different in cultures about what creates kind of that sense of happiness, or has it been largely the same?
Yeah, no, I've found a lot of differences and I've been fascinated by it because if for anyone who's remotely interested in happiness, you could say to them, hey, what's the happiest country in the world? And nearly everyone knows immediately they go to the Scandinavian countries. They say Denmark, Finland, you know, like they're going to that sort of Nordic area. But what's fascinating is it depends on how you define happiness. So if you say, hey, what are the happiest countries in the world in terms of sense of purpose and contentment, then yes, the Scandinavian countries do exceptionally well there. They score remarkably highly. But if you say, what are the happiest countries in the world in terms of that positive affect, joy, celebration of life, zest for life, you know, that real like excitement and enthusiasm for life. Well, the highest ranking country is actually a lot of the Latin American countries. We see that come through in Costa Rica. Oh. We see that in Colombia. We see that in... And so just a subtle little shift on, are we focusing more on joy and pleasure and excitement? Or are we focusing more on contentment, you know, purpose? And then if you flip it one more time and go, which country scores the highest and is the happiness, happiest country related to achievement, accomplishment, and pride? So more that A in the PERMA model. Mm-hmm. It's actually Singapore. And so you've got three distinctly different parts of the world, remarkably different cultures, arguably all the happiest in the world, depending on which element of happiness, which flavor of happiness we look at. And I believe we can learn something from all of them. Right? We can take a little bit of each and go, how do we blend these together? You know, I mean, the challenge for our background and the countries that we're from is, I think Australia just dropped out of the top 10 happiest countries in the world. I mean, the US, I don't think has ever made it. I think Canada's also dropped out of the top 10, but we got a bit of work to do. We're going to build back up.
Yeah, we have some work to do on you know what, probably every part of the PERMA model.
Yeah.
We could have some work to do, but you know what? If I think about the US, although I'm biased in my, you know, my media and my conditioning over the years, because they're probably not going to share a lot of the things they haven't accomplished, but I think they may be over-focused on accomplishments throughout the gestation of the country. And this is totally just popping into my mind right now, which is like, you know, in age, it is a young country. Maybe the countries that are younger are at you, you know, were like you when you came out of high school trying to climb Kilimanjaro and maybe realizing like it's not all about like achievements in science and, you know, media or movies, you know, maybe there's something else going on here that other countries have figured out.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think, I don't know, look, I was born in the US. I've been in Australia for like my whole life. So I've got a little bit of a weird blend between the two. I've always said I think the US does exceptionally well at celebrating its successes and might need to get a little bit better at reconciling with its struggles. And Australia is the exact opposite. We do a little too well at over-focusing on struggles. In a way, we love the Aussie battler. We love the underdog. We've got a real tall poppy syndrome issue in the country. And we need to do a little bit better at celebrating our successes and kind of being proud of ourselves. And so you can get the two work together. Something I'm excited about, or I think is a good foundation, is, I mean, the US literally has enshrined in their constitution the pursuit of happiness. I think if we can take that from a pursuit of happiness to a realization of happiness as well, fantastic.
Yeah, I only recently read the Constitution in full in January, and it was a very impressive document, more impressive than I ever even realized, because I think, you know, in daily life, we focus on a lot of the things that have gone wrong, which is understandable. But I thought that it was right there. But, you know, I guess because it's a big, these big concepts, what would be useful is like, what are some of the kind of everyday daily practices that you might recommend to people who are listening to start their journey even towards greater happiness?
I call it the ABCs. It's like whenever someone says to me, what are the first skills people need to learn to live a happier life, or the core principles, I come back to the ABCs. The ABCs being, first and foremost, awareness. Now, this means awareness of self and awareness of emotions. We cannot, everyone talks about emotional intelligence, but you fundamentally can't intelligently manage your emotions if you don't know what they are, if you can't recognize them and name them. And so before we have emotional intelligence, we need emotional awareness and emotional literacy. So starting just by going, can I even name my emotions? Do I know what they feel like? You know, do I know what my values are and what matters to me? Coming back to that self-awareness. So awareness first and foremost. In terms of practical tools to help with that, my favorite ones are my favorite ones because they're free and they don't take long. So even if you're super busy, you can do them. Journaling, meditation. Two things that help us introspect. I love journaling because it allows us to get things out of our head and onto paper. I think too often we try to solve our mental and emotional challenges in the same place they started from, which is between our ears. And that means we're playing at a home court disadvantage. Like we're wrestling our thoughts and feelings on their home turf. We're not going to do well, right? Whereas when we get out of our head and onto paper, we get breathing room, we get space, and we go, okay, now I'm ready to grapple with you a little bit. Now I'm ready to make sense of you. And so journaling of any
name
type.
Name it to tame it.
Yeah, meditation of any type, best way to do it. That's our awareness. The B is boundaries. Learn how to recognize, communicate, and uphold important boundaries in your life. That's the key part there. So recognize, so A, know them. B, communicate them well. Don't just assume that people will know what your boundaries and needs are. I think often in important relationships, we go, oh, well, they care about me, so they should just know. It's like, well, yeah. I've never communicated that to them, so it's unfair for me to expect them to do it. And then uphold is the third step of it, which is even after you've communicated it well, give some people some grace and time to adapt to your boundaries. I think it's unfair to be like, hey, this is really important to me. You know, I'd really like to see you change your behavior, how you interact in that space. And if they don't nail it straight away, we persecute them for it. It's like behavior change takes time. Give them a bit of, you know, remind them, be clear and firm, but also be compassionate and lead by example on it. You know, the example I always give with this is if you say, hey, it's really important to me to have better boundaries around not working from home. Well, if you've told your boss that and then you're responding to emails at 7 p.m. on a, you know, Wednesday night, you're literally showing, hey, I don't even believe in my boundaries. I told you this is important, but I'm not respecting it. Right? So like, why should you respect it?
Right.
So if we can do those three well, that's going to
be
interesting.
You know, I see that in relationships a lot too.
Mm.
Not mine, I can say assuredly, but I see it in a lot of relationships because, you know, Hamza's, they've all met Hamza on episode one. They know he's a very good communicator. But I do see it in a lot of relationships where someone is saying, like, I want you to, you know, I want you, like, to your point, I want you to know what I need to be happy. I want you to know. And okay, well, now you've told them that you do want them to ask you, but then when they ask you how you're doing, it's not the right time. And you've snapped saying that it's not the right time. And then it's like, okay, well, that person's like, well, what do you want to be happy then? Because I thought it was asking me, you know, checking in on you, but actually it was checking in on you at the right time. So, you know, it's like, totally, I see what you're saying about clarity on what you need, including the boundaries, and then being extra clear, communicating them.
Yep. And that's why these ABCs kind of happen in order. You can't do the boundaries if you don't have the awareness of self first. If you don't know what you want, how are you going to communicate that to the people around you? And then once you've set the boundaries well, it gives you the space and capacity to then move into C, which is compassion towards ourselves and towards others. So being able to go... It's hard to practice compassion when you're burnt out, overwhelmed, and overextended, which is why the boundaries need to come first. Like, it's so hard to give yourself and others a bit of understanding, a bit of empathy when you're absolutely running on empty. And so if we get the boundaries right first, it allows us to have enough in our tank to then be a bit more forgiving and understanding, yes, with others, but also importantly with ourselves, to go, hey, I'm a human being, I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to drop the ball. I'm going to stuff up. I'm going to be a fallible person. And that's okay, right? I can give myself some understanding about that and not be so harsh on myself. There's a massive wave happening in positive psychology research at the moment to move away from self-esteem, which is normally so built on how we compare ourselves to others, and move towards self-compassion. They've found that self-compassion is way more correlated with a positive self-relationship, positive self-image, with good relationships with other people, with well-being, than pursuing self-esteem or self-worth is. And normally self-esteem or self-worth
comes
as a byproduct.
Well, can you explain the difference to people for whom they're thinking, well, I don't know if I have esteem or compassion when I'm talking to myself?
Yeah. So I think the biggest way to think of it is self-esteem is often inherently conditional, right? It's like, self-esteem is I like myself because of XYZ. Well, what happens if XYZ and Z are taken away? How do we then treat ourselves? And a lot of the time, and I definitely did this for a lot of my life, we go into self-criticism, we go into self-judgment. You know, we really persecute ourselves for it. And it's almost like we're chasing this kind of like, there's this inherent core of I'm not good enough as I am, right? And now you can enter whatever word you want mm-hmm. afterwards, but the deepest insecurity that most people experience is I'm not, insert whatever word you want, enough. I'm not smart mm-hmm. enough. I'm not wealthy enough. I'm not tall enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not whatever it may be, right? There's this underlying grain of I'm not enough. And so we try to bury that underlying insecurity with self-esteem by racking up things that we can point to and go, well, this is why, you know, I am enough. This is why I'm a good person. Self-compassion, on the other hand, goes, hey, it's okay for me to not feel perfect. It's okay for me to see my dark side and to know that I have things that I'm working on and struggling mm-hmm. with. It's okay for me to stuff up and make mistakes and drop the ball and learn from it, right? So self-compassion mm-hmm. doesn't just go, yeah, let's sit there and wallow in it. It's kind of like how we would treat a really close friend and a loved one. We'd be like, hey, this is a tough time. I get it. Yeah. You made a mistake. And then after acknowledging those feelings, after hearing them, after being present, then we can look at solutions. Then we can look at change. Right? But if anyone's mm-hmm. ever been in a situation where they're like, man, I've just had a really tough day, and someone jumps immediately to solution mode, you'll know something doesn't quite feel right, right? It doesn't kind of hit the spot.
That's me.
Yeah.
I'm the one who jumps right to solution. And sometimes I have been told, this is a listen conversation.
So, I don't need to solve this. I just need to be heard and validated.
I can't help it.
Right. And so I think that's, if we can lean into that a little bit more, then we end up in a better place. And then the last technique. So again, if I look at these, what are four core things I think everyone could work on as a starting point for happiness? Awareness of self and emotions, boundaries, mm-hmm. compassion towards self and others. And our last one, the S, self-care, mm-hmm. which when I say self-care, I mean self-care that is comprehensive, that is consistent. Self-care that mm-hmm. is more than just, you know, a bubble bath and a glass of wine on Sunday, kicking the feet off. It's something that enriches us. It fills our cups back up. And I always look through a lens of, we want to have self-care that kind of hits the big three. Physical self-care to look after our body. Mental mm-hmm. self-care to stimulate our brain and our learning and development. And emotional or spiritual self-care to sort of nourish our soul. If you can mm-hmm. hit the three and have practices that you prioritize and you implement on a consistent basis, I promise you, you're going to feel a lot better. But again, to get to that point, you've kind of got to nail the first ones beforehand.
Yeah. Start with the A.
Yep. Start with A.
And get the to know ABCs. Yourself. Is it the same, do you think, these components for workplaces? Like if you were saying to a company, like if you want your people to be happy, would you be saying, let me help you figure out your ABCs?
No. So the ABCs, I find, are really applicable to an individual level. And then obviously can scale through to an organization. But from a top-down approach, like an organizational structure, mm-hmm. this is what I did my master's thesis on. I was like, how would happiness even be defined and measured in an organizational mm-hmm. setting? Like I'm here going, hey, happiness should be a KPI, because we know that happy staff lead to so many positive outputs. Right? Productivity is mm-hmm. better, turnover is better, resilience is better, change management is better. Like, people are better leaders when they're happy than when they're not. So like everything comes down river from, are your people fundamentally happy? Right? And so I went, okay, well, we know that that's the case, but how would we even define that and measure it? And what I found in the research were what I call the big five. So five pillars that a happy workforce is built upon. And the first is well-being. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, mm-hmm. does our team have good well-being overall? Again, you could look at different dimensions for that: financial well-being, social well-being, sure. environmental well-being, et cetera, et cetera. But well-being is a big one. The second one is engagement, which is, does our team care about their work? Are they driven by it? You know, do they see meaning and purpose in it? You know, are they passionate about what they do? So we have engagement. Then we have culture as our third one in there. Mm-hmm. These are a lot of the underlying things like diversity, equity, inclusion, psychological safety, transparency and trust, vision, mm-hmm. mission, values. Do we have those in place to actually have an underlying foundation that is conducive to happiness? Because you can have high well-being mm-hmm. and high engagement, but if the underlying foundation is rocky, if your foundations aren't laid, eventually something's mm-hmm. going to crumble. Right? It's just a matter of time. Our fourth one of the big five is leadership. do we have emotionally intelligent,
for sure,
compassionate leaders and managers? And it's what I've been finding more and more in the research is that one has probably the biggest influence on the first three. Like, if you want a surefire way to try to drag well-being, engagement, and culture up, focus on your leaders. And if you want a way to absolutely tank your well-being, engagement, and culture, have terrible leaders. Right? It's just
I found the exact same.
Everything follows leadership. Like, get the right people in leadership management, and a lot will follow.
I have found that the top contributor in employee engagement is your direct manager.
Yep. Yeah.
And leadership.
There was a study recently, right, that came out that was like, our direct manager at work has more of an impact on people's personal well-being and health than their doctor. Like,
which, because we spend so that makes much so much sense to me.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
You might see your doctor, what, once, twice a year, ideally, less if you look it up for yourself, right? You're with your manager every week.
So, of course,
they're have a big impact.
So then what's the fifth pillar?
Fifth pillar is resiliency. Now, this is, I was debating whether or not to include it when I did my master's research, because I went, it's almost a lag measure of the first four, right? Is the reason I include it as a separate factor is it kind of gives us a gauge on how long things have been an issue for. So for example, when we test this in organizations, we built a tool, an evidence-based tool, to survey all of these and measure them and keep organizations accountable to them. If I say, hey, our staff has, you know, relatively low well-being, relatively low engagement, relatively low culture, relatively low in leadership, but their resiliency is still really high, I start going, what changed recently? Because these things seem to have dropped recently, because our team is still resilient to change. They're still leaning into change. They're not at the point of burnout yet. Whereas if I see that lower, I'm like, oh, this has been going for a while. So it kind of gives us a gauge on how long things have been playing out.
Interesting.
Which is why we included it as that fifth factor. It's important to look at as, I guess, a factor on its own, even though it is more of a lag measure of the first four.
Well, I love that you are combining, you know, what I would call the top-down and bottom-up approach. Is, you know, the bottom-up is what individuals can do for our own happiness. But we understand that systems are at play here and that there's something that corporations can do too. And actually, this does lead quite nicely into our thought experiment for this episode, Declan, because your third pillar that you're playing with was, you know, society. And in thought experiments, in this segment, which is in every episode, we'll kind of dive into a hypothetical situation related to one of the episode's topics and kind of allows for exploration into an idea without consequences or possibilities or really the constraints of reality. And so when I was putting together one for you, I was thinking, you know, if we had the privilege, I called it the Happiness Island experiment, where let's say we were imagining that we were tasked with creating an island society from scratch where the primary goal is maximizing the happiness of its people. What foundational principles would you establish, and how would you structure society, work, leisure, and education to foster happiness? So there's a lot going on here, but in my mind, I'm like, we've got the individuals, we've got the organizations, but if we had a chance to kind of like make our own society, what would be your initial ingredients for happiness?
I love this question.
It's a big one, but it's a thought experiment.
Yeah. So my first reaction when I heard this was this a Gilligan's Island Lost sort of island where there's like 15 of us stuck on a beach somewhere? Because that's going to be different. Or I'm probably going to lean more towards a different society of like, technically, this is what I'm doing.
Okay. We did not just suffer a dramatic tragedy. Okay.
Okay. We didn't just have a plane crash. We're not all stranded. Okay, cool. So I think of this more in the sense of, long term, this is probably where I'm going to be going for my PhD research. Technically, Australia is an island. We're the world's largest island. My PhD research is how do we make Australia a happier nation? Long term.
Perfect. What's your hypothesis?
Right. And so the thing that I would lean into is we don't necessarily have to start from scratch. We have some great examples that we can learn from. So again, let's look at the Scandi countries and see what they do really well. So things they do exceptionally well. They have incredible gender equality. They've got encouragement of quite lengthy and generous maternity and paternity leave to give people real access to those early years of supporting their children at home. They have a high degree of
women in leadership positions, right? We have a lot of social equity and equality in these countries. We have a real focus around nature and being connected to our environment and taking care of our environment as well. So I'd lean into that.
Yeah.
I think we can learn from that. I think we can learn a lot from the Kingdom of Bhutan, which was the first country to ever come out and say, we are never going to compete on a global scale at GDP or economics because we're a tiny nation. Like, we just fundamentally cannot compete.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But we can compete on how happy and well our citizens are. And so this comes back to the principle of measure what matters.
Right.
Are we measuring, engaging our success on happiness and well-being? So I'd look at that for our island nation. What are the core underlying principles and measurements that dictate policy decisions that our leaders are helping?
And what would be one of those? What would be one of those decisions that they make there?
Such a huge one that I think, unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of countries move away from, particularly throughout COVID, we saw move away from, is trust and transparency in institution. Like, we've seen an absolute plummet
Definitely.
In people's trust in large-scale institution, be it government, large business, media, whatever it may be. That's such a core component of having a happy society. Especially when you're at the level of society where you, you know, there's a lot of people. So you need structure.
You're inspiring me.
And so we need...
So on our island...
Yeah.
Let's call our island BU Island.
Okay.
And we've put some people there. And it sounds like we are starting with leadership that is transparent. Yep. So would our 100 people, let's just say, would our 100 people vote in the leaders? Would that be the method?
Yep.
I think it would be the method too. I think to generate the most happiness. That would be my guess.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't remember who said it, but it's been said before. I've read the quote that, you know, democracy is the best of all, you know, faulted systems that we have. It's not a perfect system in and of itself.
It's young. I mean, it is young. It is a young system, but it is an attempt. And so let's pretend on our island then, you know, we vote leaders in. I think it sounds like we need to have gender parity in leadership. You know, like taking your elements of happiness from these other places on our island, on BU Island. 100%. So not just one leader, but maybe like how many leaders should we have in a group of 100?
Oh, that's a tough question. I'd want to have, I'm going to say, let's go 10%. 10% is a nice round number. It's enough to encourage.
I was thinking 10 too.
Debate and discussion amongst groups. Without being so many cooks in the kitchen that we're just going to be bogged down in debate and discussion. Right? It's like we need action as well.
Right.
So let's go 10. I think the other thing that we really need in this, and, you know, I was never a big believer in this until there's a great there's a great book called it's called The Nordic Edge. I think it's by two Australian researchers who basically went, what can we learn from the Scandi countries that is applicable to other nations, right, and to other cultures? And the first chapter, and I went, oh, I'm not sure about this because I lean a little left socially, a little right economically. They're like, raise taxes. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, okay, like I'm not ready for this. They're like, raise taxes on the condition that there is high transparency and trust in government and organization and that we have a really high safety net on our basic needs. Right. So we look at a lot of these countries that are doing well in happiness.
Is there taxes on Happiness Island?
Yes.
Is there currency on Happiness Island?
I think there'd need to be to a degree, especially as there, again, it's the best of a faulted system, but I think we need to have it, especially when you add layers and layers of complexity, because we might start with 100 people on Happiness Island, but if you follow any population curve and graph, we're going to be at 1 million pretty quickly. So we need something to help with that. But yeah, I think taxes need to, you know, provided they're spending the right places. I think giving people access to free healthcare, giving people access to free education, giving people access to childcare so that if they want to partake in the workforce, they're not limited by the financial constraint of childcare, right? Helping support people later in life and support an aging population. These are all basic principles that we need taxes to pay for, but we need to make sure they're being spent in the right places. It's a very important
living part. And learning at any age.
Yes.
Should
yes.
be oh, taken I like
that.
Care
That's
of
a really good summary
like.
Of it. Yeah. Are we covering people's basic needs to live and not just get by, but like live healthily and live well?
Like literally live.
And to live.
Yeah, healthily. Well, education, yeah, that would have to be free. Everyone would be happier. But how now do we start everybody off on BU Island with the same amount of money?
I have recently become quite a fan. This doesn't answer the question of what do we start with, but I think it answers the question of what do we continue with. I've become quite a fan of universal base income. I actually think it's a model that from the tests we've seen and the research we've seen, you know, people on one hand and in one camp worry, you know, if people are getting enough money just coming in automatically each week to cover their basic needs and survival expenses, then they lose their drive. They don't work as hard. We saw the exact opposite in most research studies where it gives people the safety and comfort and breathing room to go, what do I actually want to do? What difference do I actually want to make? And they'll go and do that. So I don't know how to answer the question. Does everyone start
And the funny thing is like...
But I do think UBI is, we would have that on the island.
Okay, I love that. I love that, which is like, I'm a fan too, because I think it's a fear-based decision to not want it. It's like someone's going to be taking from my pie is usually, you know, the defense. But actually, to your point, even if there are jobs that, you know, you can still incentivize jobs with more money than the universal base. All we're saying is like, can you live? Can you live and learn, basically, right? That's really good. That's a good one.
I mean, look at Maslow's hierarchy. Like, when people's survival needs and basic physiological needs are taken care of, eventually they do have an inherent desire to move up the ladder a bit. We do want to start creating good community and connection. We do want to start having good emotional needs. We do want to achieve self-actualization. And I think there's just unfortunately still such a massive percentage of the population that discussions like this, talking about fulfilling your potential, talking about happiness, are so foreign because understandably their day and time is consumed with, I need to make enough money to put food on the table. I need to make enough money 100%. To pay rent. Right? And so I think we're capping our potential as a species by not giving people, you know, the basic rights to, as you said, to live and to learn, to then move into those higher order levels of thinking.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that I think you'll appreciate in Maslow's research, one thing that's often left out of the telling about the theory is that he didn't envision it as a pyramid. He actually envisioned it as a ladder that you could have different parts of your body in, you know, like at different times, and that you could be achieving some basic needs and some safety needs and some self-actualization. And actually my favorite part of the model is when he extended it to include something above self-actualization, which was transcendence. And I feel like a lot of what you've gotten to today is, you know, once you have a limb in each of these sections, how do we transcend to others? We have lots more to talk about, but we are coming to the end of our conversation here today. And I always end each episode with the train of thought, which is connecting the last episode to this one. And this has been going since the very first episode. So I'm going to give you the topic that they summed up the last episode with, and your challenge is to connect it to what we've talked about today. So first things first, what would you say is kind of one of the major themes or even summary topics that we've covered today?
I think the biggest kind of core, if I was to digest our entire conversation into one sentence, is that happiness is a skill. And it's a skill that's relevant to individuals, organizations, and countries.
Well, this one is an interesting one because I don't think it's obvious on the surface. So your challenge is to connect this idea to the idea of the past episode, which was, she summed it up as, we've really talked about how the past impacts the present and our future. So we've really talked about how the past impacts our present and our future. How does that connect to something as happiness is a skill? This is one of the more challenging connections, I will say.
I think when it comes, I'm going to look at this through like a psychology lens. And historically and traditionally, clinical psychology, deficit model psychology. It's done a lot of good work for the world, and it still continues to do a lot of good work for the world. But it was historically, in my opinion, over-focused on our past and under-focused on our future. Positive psychology has come along, flipped that a little bit. It's gone, hey, we're going to focus on how we move forward with a good future, but also acknowledge that part of moving forward to a good future is reconciling with and grappling with and processing our past. So when it comes to working on these skills, I think we need to acknowledge and understand that our past has a role to play in how we build the skills of happiness, but it is not deterministic of how we build the skills of happiness in the future. It influences
That is a good one, people. You know, Declan's just given you, I think, the magic sauce, which is happiness is something we all want for ourselves. And what he's just said is your past may have contributed, you know, to where you are at now. But if you believe that happiness is a skill, you can do things in the present to change that future to become happier. That is a perfect way to sum up the episode. Declan, is there anything else? I mean, there's lots of things I could continue talking to you about on any one of these, but is there anything else you want people to know? If you could say one more piece of advice for them before we go.
Yeah, I guess my one piece of advice to leave people with is please don't think that you prioritizing your happiness is a selfish pursuit. I'm a huge believer that when we're happy and fulfilled, we are better partners, parents, lovers, community members, leaders. And so I actually believe the most selfish thing we can do is rob our loved ones, our workplaces, and our communities of the chance to get to know the best us. And so by prioritizing your happiness, you give the world, that's literally why we called the happiness college I run BU, because I think the greatest and most beautiful gift we can give the world is to be ourselves wholeheartedly. And through that lens, we can see that prioritizing your happiness is not selfish. It's incredibly generous.
I love that. Thank you very much for coming today.
So welcome. Thanks for having me.